Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, I ended talking about the concept of a government with a heart, solving the problem of third world debt. There was a quote from the Wizard of Oz film when the Wizard of Oz was talking to the Tin Woodman. He said, "Remember, my fine friend, a heart is not judged by how much you love, but by how much you are loved by others." End of the quote. In the 19th century, the corporation was given the legal status of a person, although it was a person without a heart, incapable of love and charity. Its sole legal motive was to make money for its stockholders, ignoring such external costs as environmental destruction and human oppression. The U.S. government, by contrast, was designed to be a social organism with a heart. The Founding Fathers stated as their guiding principles that all men are created equal, that they are endowed with certain inalienable rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that the function of government is to provide for the general welfare. If the major corporate banking entities that are now in control of the nation's money supply were made agencies of the U.S. government, they could incorporate some of these humanitarian standards into their business models. And one important humanitarian step these public banks would be empowered to take would be to forgive unfair and extortionate third world debt. Most third world debt today is held by U.S. based international banks. If those banks were made federal agencies, either by purchasing their stock or by acquiring them in receivership, the U.S. government could declare a day of jubilee, a day when oppressive third world debts were forgiven across the board. The term itself comes from the biblical book of Leviticus, in which Jehovah himself, evidently recognizing the mathematical impossibility of continually collecting debts at interest compounded annually, declared a day to be held every 49 years when debts would be forgiven and the dispossessed could return to their homes. Unlike when Jehovah did it, however, a day of jubilee declared by the U.S. government would not be entirely a selfless act. If the United States is going to pay off its international debts with new greenbacks, it is going to need the goodwill of the world. Forgiving the debts of our neighbors could encourage them to forgive ours. Other countries have no more interest in seeing the international economy collapse than we do, but if they are spooked by the market, they could rush to dump their dollars along with everyone else, bringing the whole shaky debt edifice down. Forgiving third world debt could show our good intentions, quell market jitters, and get everyone on the same page. Our shiny new monetary scheme, rather than appearing to be more sleight of hand, could unveil itself as a millennial model for showering abundance everywhere. Forgiving third world debt could have a number of other important benefits, including a reduction in terrorism. In a 2004 book called The Debt Threat, How Debt is Destroying the Developing World and Threatening Us All, Norina Hertz notes that career terrorists are signing up for the radical employment because it pays a salary when no other jobs are available. Relieving third world debt would also help protect the global environment, which is being destroyed piece by piece, to pay off international lenders. And it could help prevent the spread of diseases that are being bred in impoverished conditions abroad. The United States has actually been looking for a way to cancel third world debt. It just hasn't been able to reach agreement with its fellow IMF members on how to do it. When the IMF talks on forgiving debt, it isn't talking about any acts of magnanimous generosity on the part of the banks. It is talking about shifting the burden of payment from the debtor countries to the wealthier donor countries, or drawing on the IMF's gold reserves to ensure that the banks get their money. In the fall of 2004, the United States decided that Iraq's $120 billion debt should be canceled. But if oil-rich Iraq merited debt cancellation, much poorer countries would too. Under the Heavily Indebted Poor Country, HIPC, initiative of 1996, rich nations agree to cancel $110 billion in debt to poor nations. But by the fall of 2004, only about $31 billion had actually been canceled. The 30 or so poorest nations, most of them in Africa, still had a collective outstanding debt of about $200 billion. At a meeting of finance ministers, the United States took the position that the debts of all the poorest nations should be canceled outright. The sticking point was where to get the funds. One suggestion was to revalue and sell the IMF's gold, but objection was raised that this would simply be another form of welfare to banks that had made risky loans, encouraging them to continue in their profligate loan sharking. And we'll return to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, the Wizard of Oz might have said that this was another instance of disorganized thinking. The problem could be solved in the same way that it was created, by sleight of hand. The debts could be canceled simply by voiding them out on the bank's books. no depositors or creditors would lose any money because no depositors or creditors advanced their own money in the original loans. According to British economist Michael Rowbotham, writing in 1998, quote, of the $2,200 billion currently outstanding in the third world, or developing country debt, the vast majority represents money created by commercial banks in parallel with debt. In no sense do the loans advanced by the World Bank and IMF constitute monies owed to the creditor nations of the World Bank and IMF. The World Bank cooperates directly with commercial banks in the creation and supply of money in parallel with debt. The IMF also negotiates directly with commercial banks to arrange combined IMF commercial loan packages. As for those sums loaned by the IMF, from the total quota supplied by member nations, these sums also do not constitute monies owed to creditor nations. The monies subscribed as quotas were initially created by commercial banks. Both quotas and loans are owed, ultimately, to commercial banks. Close quote. If the money is owed to commercial banks, it was money created with accounting entries. Rowbotham observes that third world debt represents a liability on the bank's books only because the rules of banking say their books must be balanced. He suggests two ways the rules of banking might be changed to liquidate unfair and oppressive debts. Quote, the first option is to remove the obligation on banks to maintain parity between assets and liabilities, or to be more precise, to allow banks to hold reduced levels of assets equivalent to the third world debt bonds they cancel. Thus, if a commercial bank held $10 billion worth of developing country debt bonds, after cancellation, it would be permitted in perpetuity to have a $10 billion deficit in its assets. This is a simple matter of record keeping. The second option, and in accountancy terms, probably the more satisfactory, although it amounts to the same policy, is to cancel the debt bonds, yet permit banks to retain them for purposes of accountancy. The debts would be canceled so far as the developing nations were concerned, but still valid for the purposes of a bank's accounts. The bonds would then be held as permanent, non-negotiable assets at face value. Close quote. Third world debt could be eliminated with the click of a mouse, in other words. Old debts can be wiped off the books, but the same debt syndrome will strike again unless something is done to stabilize national currencies. As long as currencies can be devalued by speculators, third world currencies will be exporting goods for a fraction of their value and overpaying for imports, keeping them impoverished. The U.S. dollar itself could soon be at risk. If global bondholders start dumping their bond holdings in large quantities, short sellers could fan the flames, collapsing the value of the dollar, just as speculators collapsed the German mark in 1923. To counteract commercial risks from sudden changes in the value of foreign currencies, corporations today feel compelled to invest heavily in derivatives, hedging their bets so they can win either way. But derivatives themselves are quite risky and expensive, and they can serve to compound the risk. Some other solution is needed that can return predictability, certainty, and fairness to international contracts. The Bretton Woods gold standard worked to prevent devaluations and huge trade deficits like the United States now has with China, but gold ultimately failed as a currency peg. The U.S. government, the global banker, had insufficient gold reserves for clearing international trade balances, and it eventually ran out of gold. Gold alone has also proved to be an unstable measure of value, since its own value fluctuates widely. Some new system is needed that retains the virtues of the gold standard while overcoming its limitations. One solution that has been tried is for countries to stabilize their currencies by pegging them directly to the U.S. dollar. The maneuver has worked to prevent currency devaluations, but the countries have lost the flexibility they needed to compete in international markets. In Argentina between 1991 and 2001, a currency board maintained a strict one-to-one peg between the Argentine peso and the U.S. dollar. The money supply was fixed, limited, and inflexible. The dire result was national bankruptcy in 1995 and again in 2001. In the extreme form of dollar pegging, called full dollarization, the fully dollarized country simply abandons its local currency and uses only U.S. dollars. Ecuador converted to full dollarization in 2000, and El Salvador did it in 2002. Certain benefits were realized, including reduced interest rates, reduced inflation, a stable currency, and a measure of economic growth. But when neighboring countries devalued their own currencies, the dollarized countries' products became more expensive and less competitive in global markets. Dollarized countries also lost the ability to control their own money supplies. When the El Salvador government increased unexpected expenses, it could not finance them either by issuing its own currency or by issuing bonds that would be funded by its own banks, since neither the government nor the bankers had the ability to create dollars. The country's money supply was fixed and limited, forcing the government to cut budgeted programs to make up the difference, and that seriously hurt the poor, since welfare programs got slashed first. Another proposed solution to the floating currency conundrum is for the world to convert en masse to a single currency. Proponents say this would do on a global level what the standardized dollar bill did on a national level for the United States and what the euro did on a regional level for the European Union. But critics point out that the world is not one nation or one region, and they question who would be authorized to issue this single currency. If all governments could issue it at will, the global money supply would be vulnerable to irresponsible governments that issued too much. If, on the other hand, the global currency could be issued only by a global central bank on the model of the IMF, the result would be the equivalent of full dollarization for the world. Countries would not be able to issue their own currencies or draw on their own credit when they needed it for internal purposes. As in El Salvador, whenever they had crises that put unusual demands on the national budget, they would not have the option of generating new money to meet those demands. They would be forced to tighten their belts and pursue austerity measures or borrow from the world central bank with all the globalization hazards those compound interest loans entail. There is, however, a third possibility. Nations could trade locally in their own currencies, but trade internationally with a global reserve currency issued through a global central bank owned by a democratic world parliament. Loans of the global reserve currency could be made at no or very low interest. In effect, borrowers would just be monetizing their own credit. We've seen that what has driven the third world into inescapable debt is the compound interest trap. Interest charges are estimated to compose about half the cost of all public projects. If interest to financial middlemen were eliminated, loans would merely be advances against future production, which could be repaid from that production. Borrowing nations would have to repay the money on a regular payment schedule, just as they do now, and after a certain ceiling has been reached, they could not borrow more until old debts had been repaid. But without the burden of compound interest, they should be able to repay their loans from the goods and services produced, rents from housing, fees charged for publicly developed energy and transportation, and so forth. If they could not repay their loans, they could seek adjustments from the World Parliament, but decisions concerning when and how much to increase the national money supply would otherwise be their own. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. An economic model that is democratic and fair to all members is being developed by an organization called the World Constitution and Parliament Association, which postulates an Earth Federation working for equal prosperity and well-being for all Earth's citizens. The global funding body would be authorized not only to advance credit to nations, but to issue money directly on the model of Lincoln's greenbacks and the IMF's SDRs. These funds would then be dispersed as needed for the Commonwealth of Earth. Money would be issued debt-free and would be based on people's potential productive capacity in goods and services. The Earth Federation would have a common currency that was valued the same everywhere based on the principle of equal pay for equal work. Some such overhaul might be possible in the future, but in the meantime, global trade is conducted in many competing currencies, which are vulnerable to speculative attack by pirates prowling in the sea of floating exchange rates. That risk needs to be eliminated. But how? So let's start answering that question with another quote from The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, The Journey to the Great Oz. Quote, "Suddenly they came to another gulf across the road. They sat down to consider what they should do, and after serious thought, the scarecrow said, 'Here is a great tree standing close to the ditch. If the woodman can chop it down so that it will fall to the other side, we can walk across it easily.' 'That is a first-rate idea,' said the lion. 'One would almost suspect you had brains in your head instead of straw.'" End quote. In his 1911 book, The Purchasing Power of Money, Irving Fisher wrote that for money to serve as a unit of account, a trusted medium of exchange, and a reliable store of value, its purchasing power needs to be stable. But substances existing by the bounty of nature, such as gold or silver, cannot have that property because their values fluctuate with changing supply and demand. To avoid the disastrous devaluations caused by international currency speculation, governments need a single stable peg against which they can value their currencies, some independent measure in which merchants can negotiate their contracts and be sure of getting what they bargained for. Gold served as such a peg historically, but was an imperfect solution, because the value of gold itself fluctuated widely, and because gold also traded as a currency, causing the global banker, the United States, to eventually come up short. Some unit of value is needed that can stand as a lighthouse, resisting currency movements because it is independent of them. But what? The relationship between feet and meters can be fixed because the ground on which they are measured is solid, but world trade ebbs and flows in a moving sea of currency values. A solution devised in the experimental cauldron of 18th century America was to measure the value of a paper currency against a variety of goods. During the American Revolution, troops were often paid with continentals, which quickly depreciated as the economy was flooded with them. Meanwhile, goods were becoming scarce, causing prices to shoot up. By the time the Continental soldiers came home from a long campaign, the money in which they had been paid was nearly worthless. To ease the situation, the Massachusetts Bay Legislature authorized the state to trade Continentals for Treasury certificates valued in terms of the sale price of staple commodities. The certificates provided that soldiers were to be paid in the then current money of the said state in a greater or less sum as 5 bushels of corn, 68 pounds and 4/7 parts of a pound of beef, 10 pounds of sheep's wool, 16 pounds of sole leather, shall then cost more or less than 130 pounds current money at the then current prices of said articles. Nearly two centuries later, John Maynard Keynes had a similar idea. Instead of pegging currencies to the price of single precious metal, gold, they could be pegged to a basket of commodities, wheat, oil, copper, and so forth. Keynes did not elaborate much on the solution, perhaps because the world economy was not then troubled by wild currency devaluations, and because the daily statistical calculations would have been hard to make in the 1940s. But that would not be a problem now. As Michael Robotham observes, with today's sophisticated trading data, we could literally have a register of all globally traded commodities used to determine currency values. Robotham calls Keynes' proposal a profound and democratic idea that is vital to any future sustainable and just world economy. He writes, quote, "Today, wheat grown in one country may, due to a devalued currency, cost a fraction of wheat grown in another. This leads to the country in which wheat is cheaper becoming a heavy exporter, regardless of need, or the capacity to produce better quality wheat in other locations. In addition, currency values can change dramatically and the situation can reverse. Critically, such wheat prices bear no relation to genuine comparative advantage of climate, soil type, geography, and even less to indigenous local regional needs. Neither does it have any stabilizing element that would promote a long-term stability of production with relation to need. By imputing value to a nation's produce and allowing this to determine the value of a nation's currency, one is imputing value to its resources, its laborers, and acknowledging its own needs." Close quote. An international trade unit could be established that consisted of the value of a basket of commodities broad enough to be representative of national products and prices and to withstand the manipulations of speculators. This unit would include the price of gold and other commodities, but it would not actually be gold or any other commodity, and it would not be a currency. It would just be a yardstick for pegging currencies and negotiating contracts. A global unit for pegging value would allow currencies to be exchanged across national borders at exact conversion rates, just as miles can be exactly converted into kilometers and watches can be precisely set when crossing international date lines. Exchange rates would not be fixed forever, but they would be fixed everywhere. Changes in exchange rates would reflect the national market for real goods and services, not the international market for currencies. Like in the Bretton Woods system that pegged currencies to gold, there would be no room for speculation or hedging. But the peg would be more stable than in the Bretton Woods system, and because it would not trade as a currency itself, it would not be in danger of becoming scarce. To implement such a standard globally would take another round of Bretton Woods negotiations, which might not happen anytime soon, but private exchange systems have been devised on the same model, which are instructive in the meantime for understanding how such a system might work. And I will continue expanding upon this in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.